Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a high performance organization with your host, Joseph Paris. Hello, and welcome to State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat between me, Joseph Paris, as your host, and a guest who is a leader in industry. Together, we will listen and learn as our guest shares the wisdom they have acquired over the years and insights into topical goings-on. Our guest today is Daniel Bobloskis, Ph.D. He is an Associate Professor of Management and the Hamilton ESP International Fellow of Supply Chain and Logistics Management at the University of Northern Iowa, a visiting professor at the University of Washington, and holds a courtesy appointment at the University of Missouri, where he previously held a faculty appointment. Dan conducts research, teaches, and consults on various areas related to operational excellence and business development. Dan has published over 45 peer-reviewed journal articles and conference proceedings, including publications in journals such as Expert Systems with Applications, IEEE Transactions on Industry Applications, and Business Process Management. He earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Industrial Engineering and Economics from Iowa State University, a Master of Liberal Arts in General Management from Harvard University, and received his Master's of Science and Ph.D. both from Iowa State University in Industrial Engineering. Prior to his faculty appointments, Dr. Bobloskis was previously employed in industry by ABB Incorporated and Sears Holding Corporation, and currently serves as Vice President of PFC Services Incorporated, a consulting firm based in Marietta, Georgia. He's married, wife Kendra, and four children, Adeline, Taryn, Grayson, and Weston, ages 11, 10, 7, and 5, respectively. His hobbies include golfing and ice hockey, and he's also a coach for the Waterloo Youth Hockey Association. Welcome, Dan. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, Joe. That was a great introduction, professionally and personally, and hopefully I won't have too many of those homeschool children trying to break into my office here.
Not like, remember the one interview on that was being conducted on TV, and it was a Skype call, and the kid came in on a little stroller, and the nanny had to come in and rescue the interview. We hopefully there'll be none of that. And of course, this is all audio and not video, so even if something does quirky happen, we won't have to worry about it. I would hope. So, how are you doing under these circumstances with the coronavirus? Nearing peak here in the States and abroad.
Personally, my family and I are doing well, so we've been kind of hunkered down in our isolation quarantine mode, trying to go out as little as possible, like many people in the United States and around the world at the moment. Professionally, I'm fortunate to have had a fair amount of experience in online coursework, virtual meetings, working with consulting clients and students around the world, so my runway for takeoff here has been pretty manageable, as opposed to maybe some colleagues who have never had the opportunity to really work with the different technologies and remote connections that they're having to be kind of drink from a fire hose right now, right?
Yeah, having to ramp up pretty quick. And, we're fortunate, you and I are very similar in that, we're conducting business and sharing our, experiences and wisdom, if you will, from the comforts of wherever we might be to wherever they might be. I think that everybody else is getting a crash course in that, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, and I think that from a business and corporate perspective, I was lucky you mentioned that I worked for Asea Brown Bavaria ABB. So working for such a large global company, we had to do business whatever means we could, whether that meant a phone conversation, conference call. Video chat really wasn't around as prevalently as it is today. And then, of course, getting on that airplane and flying to wherever we need to go. But we, being in that sort of situation from a business perspective, it was a fairly easy personal shift into higher education to do these types of things. However, of course, there's a lot of barriers and roadblocks that exist in terms of deploying new techniques, pedagogies, things like that, as it relates to classroom teaching and learning objectives, which are a little bit different world than doing even corporate meetings and corporate trainings and universities and those types of things in more of the industry space. So I've been lucky that I've been kind of one of those people. You give me a laptop and a Wi-Fi connection and I can work anywhere in the world, right?
Yeah, I tell my wife the same thing. It's It's amazing, how much talk there is, of course, on the medical crisis. But what I want to devote this session to, if it's okay with you, is not about what we should do or what needs to be done during, but how life will change or might be permanently changed afterwards. And I think that telephony is going to be a larger part of this post-crisis existence. What are your thoughts on that?
I couldn't agree more. The technology's been here for a long time. And if you look at companies like Google and others that have been using what they call VC for video chat and Google Hangouts and Google Hangout Meet, these sorts of things have been used by companies so that we can have remote work collaboration anywhere in the world. So you might have someone sitting in Dublin, Ireland, where I tend to go a lot, connecting with someone in California directly, and they don't have to fly there, they don't have to track the other person down, and they also keep that social distance that we're hearing so much about right now. So it's become a matter of, do we really need to take that trip? What's the cost? What's the time commitment? You know, no more handshakes. Now we're doing, what, fist, elbow bumps, foot kicks, all sorts of different things like this.
I do the Vulcan sign there, live long and prosper.
Yeah. I don't know that, other than like engineers and people like that, I'm not sure that everyone in the business world would even know what that was other than people like us. But I think that in the long run, though, we're going to see significant changes. I know there's been some ramblings from the airlines about even having to create social distances within the cabins now. And how does that change their seating and layout configurations for the planes? And do I really need to take that trip or not? Now I think the silver lining is going to be the cost and time savings, of course. And I think one of the quotations and some of the authors of articles in the media right now are running with this kind of black swan moment for particularly higher education, but also for just business collaboration and working with suppliers and customers that, hey, we're kind of being forced into this, but there are some benefits to be gained for efficiency and productivity.
Yeah, I think it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a good crisis go to waste. Other than, government largesse, if you will, let's talk about that black swan moment in higher education for online technology. I've been on the advisory board of Binghamton University's System Science and Industrial Engineering Department for darn near 20 years. And what I've repeatedly heard from university is that telephonic learning is inferior to face-to-face learning. And they always look down their nose at some of these online universities because they're online and versus traditional. But here we are in the middle of this crisis, and I'm speaking to my department chair, and he's like, the university just purchased 3,000 licenses of Zoom, and we're sending all the students home, and we're going to be teaching, via Zoom. And, what happened to the idea that that's inferior? They seem to be embracing it quite boldly. What's the inside perspective,
So I think there's always going to be a place for face-to-face meetings in the face-to-face classroom. I've been hearing for 10 years how my universities are going to go under and we're going to have everything be Khan Academy, Udacity, Coursera. And there's still such personal benefit from connecting with someone on a human-to-human, face-to-face level. Particularly, I notice as I teach courses around the world, people want to meet in person. And there is still a big push for that. However, I will tell you, I'm teaching a cohort right now in Asia that was extremely hesitant and resistant to doing a fully online class and originally didn't want to do it, drug our feet. Well, once we found out it was going to be about we'll say, 9 to 12 month delay before I could come back there, then immediately we were doing the online class using Zoom and the learning management systems and things like this. And we'll talk a little bit about the technology, the quality of the instructor, and the delivery techniques and pedagogy. But what they've said after the first, the class is actually starting to wind down, but even after the first couple of class meetings, they said they had no idea through a virtual environment like Zoom, you could create a real classroom feel. So the fact that, hey, I'm not physically there in Asia with you right now. However, there are a lot of ways that we can adjust and do team breakouts, have group discussions. We've got video so we can actually see each other. So I think that some of those things are changing very, very quickly. And a lot of it's just perceptions and expectations about the technologies and giving them a try. I think a lot of people immediately shut down and say, oh, that's not going to work or that's not going to be as good. But until you experiment and try it, you don't really know how it's going to go, and you got to give it the benefit of the doubt. Now, back to your other point about what I'll call, the kind of bad name that maybe some online institutions have gotten. Part of that is kind of self-created in terms of predatory student lending, degree and certificate mill sort of development. But then, obviously, there's a lot of really, really good online institutions as well as brick-and-mortar institutions that have gone online. And then it's a matter of the quality, rigor, and developmental skills of the university and their instructor base. So do they have the skill sets needed? And like we hear so much when it comes to PhDs coming out, we are not trained to be teachers in general. We are trained to be researchers. So go into a classroom, go start teaching some stuff. Good luck, Godspeed, all the best to you. So that's how it is when you walk into a classroom. And imagine doing that online where you don't know how to use the technology either. So this is part of the problem, is that we just expect our graduate PhD students to suddenly figure out how to do all this stuff with no training or uptime. And so we've kind of created this pipeline that is woefully underskilled and trained, and now they're drinking from that fire hose I mentioned a little bit ago.
Right. You know, I mentioned to the department chair that the biggest risk I see is that professors will realize they can deliver their lectures from a beach in the Caribbean.
And hey, I'll be the first one to be on that beach. Believe me, that's like I said, give me a laptop and Wi-Fi and I can be anywhere in the world. But yeah. No, that's part of it. And then you're going to start to see a higher push towards high quality and not just high quality, but also reputation and how that plays into this as well. So as an example, I've just been kind of auditing for fun. This is what professors do, right? For fun. Auditing a Coursera course by a Yale professor on happiness that's been in the media a lot lately and kind of seeing how she structured that course. It's a kind of a positive psychology, happiness and wellness sort of class. But so you're saying you want to take happiness. Why wouldn't you learn about happiness from the highest ranking, most authoritative expert you could find in the world on that topic? Then the question is, are they able to deliver it to their audience that's out there? And where is the, I suppose, marketplace for all of the different colleges, universities, and higher learning sorts of environments that exist today, whether that's LinkedIn Learning, Lynda.com, we mentioned some of these other ones earlier. So how does this all fit together? And how do we figure out how to find these things as a student, which is why I mentioned 10 years ago, people said, oh, your job's going to go away. The universities will shutter because of online learning. Well, guess what? The students don't even know where to look for this stuff or what to look for. They need someone to help build out curriculum and process and certify that they've done some sort of program, that they've learned and accomplished something and they've met those objectives that were set forth for them. Just taking a bunch of classes online, it's hard to piece that together themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Let's get back to the FaceTime. You know, meeting face to face. Part of what I've seen as a result of this is people, instead of trying to do conferences face to face, trying to do conferences online. And I'm not sure that I'm sold on the idea of conferences online. What's the difference between a conference online and, like, you know, LinkedIn Learning or you know, all the different things you can get on YouTube, right? I mean, you know.
One of the major differentiators is that live synchronous environment versus asynchronous. So the first piece of this you mentioned, let's talk about like the live event, trade show, conference, even bigger than what I'm talking about with maybe a cohort of students in a class. We're going to see more and more of this very quickly. Pretty much everything on my calendar for the next, we'll say, 4 to 6 months has been either canceled, postponed, or moved online. Now, what's interesting is seeing which entities are canceling, which ones are postponing, and which ones are going to virtual conferences. For us, one of the biggest announcements was for business schools, at least, where I reside today in my faculty appointment, AACSB, our big accrediting body like ABET for engineering, just moved their annual conference to an online format. So this will be a really interesting one to look at how that works in terms of the process. But of course, the big struggle is networking. I just got into, for the first time, one of those online career fairs that's a live synchronous virtual career fair. And basically what you do is you have a kind of a main forum, like a lot of us have used Zoom before. So in Zoom, you have a main meeting or class, and then you can create breakout sessions and have private conversations through chat and video. So you might have, let's say, just a general career fair, like maybe we're in John Deere territory up here, right? So maybe John Deere is doing a little bit of recruiting and they want to go out and do a virtual career fair. So what they'll do is they'll have their recruiters out there and they'll have someone maybe giving a general overview to all the job applicants or folks that are interested in careers with Deere. And then that recruiter can break off and have other recruiters break off and answer individual questions, have sidebar conversations and interviews. So I think one of the things that I've noticed in so far in these virtual conferences and career fairs is not having adequate resources of human contacts to be able to break off. So usually it's like you got one person there and then suddenly you got 30 people in the room and they want to have 30 unique conversations and you don't have a second, third, fourth person to have those individual conversations with. And it's one thing to give like a lecture to 30 people. It's another thing to try to have individual conversations with 30 people simultaneously. So that's one of the challenges. How do we create that dynamic, live, synchronous environment like we find when we go to a conference or a trade show or an event? The second part with Lynda and LinkedIn Learning and Coursera and all the other ones that are out there is, how do I know what it is that I want to learn about, and then how do I piece that together? As an example, let's say I want to learn about machine learning. I just published a paper on machine learning, if anyone's interested in that topic. They can follow up with us on and see a copy of that. But when you look at machine learning, how do I even know where to begin? Like, what is the difference between machine learning and AI and all these other things? Do I just start go watching advanced lectures by faculty that talk about machine learning, or which websites and which universities and which services are the best at machine learning? I have no idea, right? So now it becomes a matter of who do I contact in my network to figure out where to go find this asynchronous content that exists. I think I spent the better part of a day just messing around on LinkedIn Learning, trying to find stuff like that. Where to go, who the instructor is, what the topic is, and kind of bouncing around between content. Now that's fun for to spend half a day learning about random stuff on machine learning or AI. But now how do I package that up into a digital badge, a certificate, a degree? That's why the universities still exist, is they're that credentialing authoritative body that creates that curriculum that then ends in some sort of outcome being either that badge, certificate, or degree, right? So there's a room and space for both synchronous and asynchronous. And actually, even in my own courses, I use both as a combination. Right. So I'll post some asynchronous content that you can go back to, and then I'll do some live meetings, Q&A, virtual office hours, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah. You know, with the conferences, though, don't you find a lot of value in the, we'll call it the extracurricular activity, you know, the casual conversations over lunch?
I don't know what you mean by, I don't know what you mean by extracurriculars. Actually, I do. I entirely know, but yeah, that personal camaraderie, team building. I tell this story all the time that even as an older undergraduate student, one of the, we won an award for a statistical process control idea that we came up with.
Uh-oh.
That was not done in a classroom. It was done in that after hour networking time, we'll call it, right? Where you're just throwing some ideas around, you're having some fun, you're doing some personal, some professional chat. Think of all those work ideas that people have around the water cooler, or, I mean, I spend a lot of time in Dublin, I said, so at the pubs, right? When it came to the COVID-19 closing the pubs in Dublin, I mean, that's like unheard of. I mean, it's just part of the culture and the life there. And so many ideas are generated from those face-to-face, relaxed, informal meetings. That is really difficult to replicate online for a variety of reasons. We get distracted. You mentioned the kids and whatever else, dogs and other people in the background. You got a million things going on and all the notifications and alerts popping up on your devices. You know, sometimes even if those devices are in your pocket at a conference, you know, you can mute that thing, shut it off, and you need to do the same thing. So you need to kind of immerse yourself in that virtual conference, shut everything down around you, and really focus on the people that are there. But it's so difficult to do that because you know, especially even look at it, my wife could come down here and say, what the heck are you doing? You know, you're just like on a virtual, what do we call this? The virtual pub sort of thing, right? So you go out and virtual happy hour. That's what I was drawing the blank on there. I've been hearing from corporate partners from our consulting firm about the companies are now moving to these virtual happy hours. And the idea is, you know, maybe we grab our favorite beverage and then we jump online with our management team or our colleagues or our cohort colleagues in the graduate programs, and we have these virtual office hour or virtual happy hours. So that's one way to maybe start that process. And I've heard really good things from some of my clients about that here just recently, like in the last week or so.
That's interesting. So does that get you give you a buy against the problem of drinking alone if you're by yourself drinking, but you're with your colleagues on a virtual happy hour? I guess ponder that.
Between us, I'm a big brewery guy. I've done some brewery sustainability things. So all this talk about virtual happy hours and favorite beverages, I'm thinking about going to grab a beer out of the fridge right now, and no one would even know, right? But I saw a funny. If anyone's seen this floating around, there's a Zoom academic bingo card. And one of the squares on the Zoom academic bingo card is someone in the group is drinking an alcoholic beverage. Put a chipper on your bingo spot for that, right? So, and there's a lot of the things we've already talked about, dogs barking, kids screaming. So what, and there's a lot of these funny parody videos and things like that. But no, you're right. I mean, I think that you get together with a group of friends, colleagues, whatever. We just have to do it differently, and it's going to be a little strange at first, right? So I think that most people would admit it's just not natural, but neither is the social distancing thing and thinking about, keeping that 6 foot between everyone. That I've also heard a lot about social barricading recently, which is like forced social distancing, especially in like manufacturing environments. So this is a really interesting time as it relates to how do we do operationally effective continuous improvement, Lean Six Sigma, all this sort of stuff in the workplace when we have to stay so far apart and we have limited resources.
Yeah, but do you think that's going to pass? I mean, I can't imagine. People, most of us are social, social animals. Okay, we're not going to keep distance. I can't imagine airlines actually thinking, we're going to have this 6 foot of separation between all of our passengers.
Passengers, yeah.
Yeah. So it's like, what is the fear and what's the reality going to be?
So just to use percentages, let's say that before this, I'm making these numbers up arbitrarily, but let's say 75% of our work was still face-to-face for a variety of reasons, and 25% was online, email, conference call. I feel like what's happening now is you've almost flipped that entirely, and now it's more like, 95% online? So you'll probably find some medium in between the two. Maybe we get to 50-50. I do agree with you. There is no way, as humans being social creatures, it's like looking at, I've got a couple of dogs, and they do what they do. But if you look at how they interact with one another, even if you try to keep them apart, they try to figure out a way to break the other one out or whatever else. I mean, they want to be together. And humans inherently have that social aspect as well that, I think the shaking hand things I'm really struggling with. You've heard some of the politicians talking about it. My natural reaction is always to go shake someone's hand. And so it's like put my hand in my pocket or something so that I'm not trying to do that. And so you're going to have some of those things like, who knows, maybe the handshake is now gone forever. However, I think you're going to find that instead of it being so much on the personal social interaction face-to-face, we're probably going to find some medium between the two that will be a balance between the online virtual meetings and the face-to-face in-person meetings.
Well, just think for a moment. I mean, I think about all the time we spend in airplanes, okay? All the time we spend even commuting to work. I mean, I used to live in New York, and I've heard of people, spending 2 hours a day commuting one way. And, couldn't it possibly be that after this is all said and done, businesses discover that they're actually able to accelerate decision-making, collaboration, everything that productivity, and bottom line, productivity is increased by not having to get together to hash things out all the time.
Yeah, and I think part of that is it's been very hard to measure productivity of people in these types of roles that do telecommuting, remote work, versus traveling to sites. There's been a big pressure on face-to-face personal meetings. As an example, one of my latter industry management roles, I had a directive basically that I had to go meet with each of my teams at 3 remote sites at least like once per quarter. Whether I needed to or not, for any business reason or whatever else, I had to physically fly. In that case, it was me flying from, at the time, usually to from Missouri to Virginia or North Carolina, pretty much exclusively those two states, for my internal team meetings. But even if I had no reason to go, I just had to go to try to build rapport with my team and do team building. Now, with the virtual office hours, that sort of thing, I think there is still some value in having met someone face-to-face at least once or twice or 3 times. But, you know, I've now flown out there like 20 times. Do I really need to go that 21st time? I mean, where does that productivity efficiency come in? So this gets back to measuring and creating metrics for performance.
Yeah.
We've always had in manufacturing, of course, we've not always, but we've placed a lot of metrics in that environment. And we've done some of that in the front and back end of what I call commercial operations. So your sales, your marketing, your accounting, your finance. How do we measure that output and that productivity? And many industries have done this different ways. But we need to start measuring that piece of business travel and effectiveness, efficiency, and productivity of those trips. I mean, people don't like to do this, partially because the executive management teams don't want to be measured on this, right? So how valuable was that trip? What were you doing? Who were you playing golf with? Who were you skeet shooting with? What, you know, so those team building activities that are really hard to measure. Now, the converse side of this is, let's say I've got an example once where I was out doing some of this rapport team building, and suddenly I got $1 million, $2 million order placed in my lap by a client while we're out on the streets of Pittsburgh. And then you go in and you say, well, what was, there was a pretty good ROI for me doing that that particular event with that client. Because who knows, would I have gotten the $2 million order? Maybe, maybe not. But, you know, that helped a lot. And so you look at that fairly low investment cost in the time and money for the events, like going to a Pirates game or whatever, and the upside in that revenue that's generated from that order. You know, this gets to be really difficult to measure, because then you have, maybe for every one of those, you have 100 that doesn't have such a high ROI.
Right. So that's, and then of course the expectation could be that every time you go on a business trip, you have a $2 million order coming back.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Exactly. So what, right. So that happened last time. Is it replicatable that it's going to happen every time you go to that Pirates game that you're going to get that $2 million order? Well, probably not. Right. But
now, you mentioned about going to the sites, you said once a quarter.
I think that was generally how it was situated. Yeah.
So, how would you square the absence of going with, for the lean term, Gemba, the need for Gemba.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how would you square not going with, that underlying philosophy of Gemba?
So the Gemba, kind of going to where the work is done for those, I'm sure most of our listeners here know about this pretty well. I think you still get into where certain industries, manufacturing being one of those, and these were manufacturing plants, mind you, so I can relate to it full-heartedly from a tangible production standpoint. There is something to be said for physically being on the floor with those people. Now, I know I have a colleague, Tor Netland, if he ends up listening to this, who's at ETH Zurich in Switzerland, and they work with ABB, ironically, right, or coincidentally, on some of these virtual factory sort of environments. I think it was at one of our big conferences a year or so ago that Tor showed off the VR for walking through one of ABB's plants, and I believe it was a plant in Switzerland. It might have been in Germany. And, you walk through there like you're physically on the floor, right, on your VR, on your phone, with your headset, what have you. And so there's something to be said for, can I create an environment where it's as if from virtual reality or these types of applications, I'm actually there even though I'm not? Is it the same? No, right? I mean, that's still that rapport building, personal connection that you have with your team members on the floor and everything else. But it's better than nothing, and you can still see what's going on firsthand as opposed to just hearing about it on a conference call or in an email or something like that. Now, today, the one way to do that in a short time without having all the sophisticated VR is just getting on FaceTime, Skype, any of these sort of video conferencing platforms, and just show me on the phone what's going on there. So this kind of idea about, and of course, now we're getting more into this with our healthcare situation of, Well, just call into a doctor on demand or nurse on demand on a phone, see what's going on. They can do some remote diagnostics of, in our case, you know, your temperature, what's happening with you, and what you want to do next. So using these technologies for those sorts of preliminary meetings. But, you know, in terms of going to the Gemba and seeing where the work's done, you still have to go see that in some way, shape, or form, whether it's physically in person or virtually through some technology.
So let's take a break, and we'll be right back after a few announcements. You've been listening to State of Readiness with your host, me, Joseph Paris, and our guest, Daniel Bomblaskis.
This episode of State of Readiness, sponsored by the Readiness Institute, the leading education center for companies who want to create an organization that recognizes time as the enemy of the 21st century company and knows the competitive advantage will go to the company that can see further beyond the horizon, recognize opportunities and threats more quickly, has achieved a superior level of operational excellence, and possesses the organizational capacity and capability to devise and deploy decisive responses faster than the competition and even the marketplace, all the while maintaining control of the narrative, and has become the high-performance organization.
Welcome back. You're listening to State of Readiness with your host, Joseph Paris, and our guest, Daniel Bomblaskis. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks again for having me, Joe.
It's really, I've loved the conversation. I love forward thinking, you know, futuristic thinking. And, you know, you're the vice president of PFC Services, and it's a consultancy. You know, what are your, you know, for lack of a better term, what's your superpowers? What do you do?
Sure. So the consultancy has been around for 20 years now, and it's what I like to call a boutique consultancy. My father and I are the two principals of the organization. He's the president, I'm the vice president, and it's a family affair. So my mother is also a vice president. My sister gets involved here and there. So it's one of those things that's really close to my heart personally and professionally. But we focus on essentially making business better from top-line revenue growth, business development, sales efficiency and effectiveness, all the way down to continuous improvement, OpEx, our true industrial engineering sort of methodologies. So it's the entire scope of the business. We're very what we call demand-based in the sense that we don't push on you specific things. Like, you need to do Six Sigma. I'm a big Six Sigma guy, full disclaimer. But I'm not going to just walk in the doors and say, we need to start doing Six Sigma because Dan said so. It's more a matter of getting a true understanding of how your business operates and then aligning our expertise, if we can help you, which generally we can, but not always, but aligning our expertise with what it is that you need to accomplish your goals and objectives as a business. Now, part of that demand-based approach has evolved over time, and we've done some academic research on demand-based management and demand chain management. There's some papers I can share with folks on that, those topics. But part of this stems from our core client base has been heavily in family and small business historically. So when you have a family and a small business, you know, you need to find ways to help them achieve their goals, whatever they may be. And they may not all be about profit generation like a large Fortune 500 publicly traded company, although we have clients in that space as well. So a lot of it's generally figuring out what it is that's going to make your company and your organization successful and how we can supplement that with our skill sets, whether that's through on-site mentorship, training and development, working with teams, executing projects and supervising projects. We kind of have the whole gamut. So it's a very custom sort of offering that we put together for our clients.
Super, super. Well, thanks for sharing that. And, you know, since you are working all over the world and you have been an early adopter, as I have, telephony, why do you think it's taken so long, you know, for the masses, for the general populace, be it education or industry, why is it taking so long for that awareness to be known?
Well, I think we've talked about some of the technological things and just getting people training to use the technologies, getting them comfortable with them, but then also just the cultural change that has to happen within an organization. So if you've got, in my case, even back to, I wasn't planning to necessarily talk about a lot of, you know, ABB management team examples. But when you look at the ABB management team, a lot of the companies came from ASEA, Brown Boveri, Westinghouse. These facilities had their own cultures, their own wherewithal that was built over really 100 plus years. If you go back to the electricity industry, is really interesting. If you, I know everyone talks about Tesla and Musk, Elon Musk now, of course, but if you look at Tesla versus Edison versus Westinghouse, this history of electrical engineering and electrification is really intriguing. But the culture is one that was built upon heavy industrial manufacturing. So when you start to suggest things like using distance or video chat like Google does, I don't know how many times I would be almost laughed out of the room because it doesn't fit that hardcore industrial manufacturing environment. I remember I've got a great story of this change. I was working with 3M up in Minneapolis on some of their energy efficiency initiatives for their facilities around the world. And you may have heard 3M has been retrofitting some plants to make some PPE for the healthcare industry, right? So 3M, they have some really, really cool innovation and creativity space up in their Minneapolis, St. Paul headquarters. And I've been there. I think we were actually supposed to go there for a conference next month that's been canceled as well. But I've been there before, and I came back with this idea to create some spaces in one of our facilities, like what I saw at 3M through my meetings there, and said, we need to try this. And I was all but laughed out of the room for suggesting that we try to do something where we actually have time to be innovative and create and think in spaces in the workplace like that. So what I would have to do is maybe work from home or reserve a conference room and close the blinds and put a sign up that says, do not knock on this door, because I have to, you know, have a moment to think. So these sorts of things where you look and you say, can we create physical and virtual spaces for people to be able to perform at a high level? Well, there's a lot of resistance to that. Is it a warm, soft, touchy-feely thing? You know, this isn't hard. You know, we're doing hardcore manufacturing here, Dan. So those sorts of things where you got to kind of figure out how can you educate people on the advantages of going this way and show once you do it once, maybe they start to buy in a little bit more and a little bit more, just kind of change agency in general. Change management is one of the topics that's probably been our most popular over the last 10 years, I would say, in terms of how do we create positive change within organizations. So it's been a really popular consulting topic.
So wouldn't you say, though, that these traditional heavy industry companies, their focus is on the physical. They make product. You know, sometimes, you know, they have machinery that makes product. They make this product in buildings. Okay, so it's very, very physical. Versus a lot of the younger companies are very rely or creating intellectual property. Okay, so they're not physically tied to anything. You don't have to be anywhere specific to think. You know, and maybe that is maybe a root cause of why some of these businesses, especially the manufacturers, have been so resistant to adapting telephonic solutions?
I think that's one of the challenges. Is the way you described it is you have kind of a black and white, we are tangible manufacturing versus intangible knowledge-based, information-based generators, maybe even a service provider. And I look at this as being a, how do you become a disruptor? So back to the late Clayton Christensen's disruptive innovator's dilemma, disruptive innovation, all these sorts of things. You look at someone like Elon Musk. I know Elon Musk gets a lot of coverage in the media. Everyone's talking about him. It's like I can't go a day on campus when we can actually go to campus that someone doesn't give me some example about what Musk is doing today. You know, whether you agree or disagree with his methods, and he has a lot of things that he does that are probably not the most politically correct, but he's also constantly innovating in both spaces, in the physical manufacturing space and engineering and design, and then also in that digital knowledge space. I mean, I don't know if Joe, ever had the chance to drive a Tesla and see some of what's going on, but, you know, it's one of those things where you look and you say, okay, you know, there's something to be learned from maybe your GM, Ford, Toyotas, all the different manufacturers of the world in terms of how to make and build a car. But then also just the information system and the protocols and the way that things work together. You know, he's created an environment that does a little bit of both, I would say. Now, one might argue that historically, so far to date, they've struggled to do both well at a high level compared to their competition, but they're trying to do both synonymously. So I think that tends to be one of those things I see as more of an excuse for organizations. You know, we're either one side or the other of this, but you really need to look at how are you driving value for your customers? Is it a physical, tangible product, or is it a service, that intangible knowledge information piece? But how are we getting there with the tools and technologies today And how can we learn from the other side? So part of what I find most interesting in what I do today is I would argue that most of what I do day in and day out as a researcher and a consultant is actually taking the manufacturing side and applying it to the service and knowledge side. So what I call kind of looking at informational work pieces. So I'm doing an underwriting of an insurance policy for Nationwide Insurance in Des Moines. How can I use the tools that we learned in manufacturing and apply that to a process like underwriting a loan, where it's all decision-driven? What's the risk of the policyholder? What should we charge as a premium? What do we think the market's like? All these sort of actuarial science questions, right? So it becomes a really interesting way of figuring out how do you fit along that spectrum of tangible product to service, and how can we learn from each other along the way?
Yeah, but you know, even financial industry went through a similar transformation, or is still going through it. Perhaps, it wasn't too long ago that a bank would have a branch everywhere, and now banks are scaling back the number of branches that they have. But I think a lot of that has to do with the demographic. Like, my parents are in their 80s, and they still go down to the bank and they still write checks. Okay, I mean, I haven't written a check in I can't tell you how long.
Yeah, I thought checks were going to be gone by now, but still, people use them all the time. And now my students will only use Venmo and PayPal and Cash App and all this sort of stuff. But it's amazing, really. And to your,
I write one check a year that I know of, and that's usually to the IRS. Thankfully, it's been deferred this year to July 15th. So,
I'm pretty sure I don't even write a check to the IRS. It's straight in and out of my bank account. I have an electronic transfer set up, I think, on that one. But anyways, to your bank example is a good one, because it gets to the point of how do you get that customer value and differentiation? There's a lot of banks online brick and mortar, just like there's a lot of universities and colleges online brick and mortar. How do you create the value for the students so that they will use your online infrastructure and whatever brick and mortar infrastructure you may have? We have a pretty progressive bank that has a new leadership team here in our area, Waterloo Cedar Falls, that has identified where the customers want to be and then do banking second. So for example, they've got a model now where they're pulling through customers through coffee shops first. I kind of like the idea of making a bar that has a bank inside of it, right? A pub in Dublin. And so we've had ATM machines in there, but I'm talking about like a mini branch, kind of like a building within a building, sort of business within a business sort of situation. So they got a coffee shop that drives the traffic, and you can do your banking while you're at the coffee shop rather than vice versa, where it's a bank that has a coffee shop inside of it. You're seeing that a lot with Walmarts, of course. So Walmarts around the country in the United States have a lot of banks lobbying to get space inside of them. Why is that? The first purpose is to go to Walmart. The second purpose is the bank, and it happens to be there. So guess what? That's the bank I'm going to open my accounts at. Now, at the same time, if their online infrastructure for security, authentication, speed, performance, if that online app and banking does not work, then you have no chance. That's like a base foundation in this modern era that I have to be able to do online banking, bill pay, all that sort of stuff. And if your technology isn't there, either your internal homegrown technology or your bought outside software, then you're not going to be able to take advantage of that other space of getting the customer to come into the coffee shop or Walmart and then do banking with us. So that's why you're seeing the full-scale standalone brick-and-mortar banks kind of go away. And now we're seeing – it's interesting because these same banks in our area, we're seeing them close with the COVID-19. And which branches are they deeming necessary and which ones are they not? And so most of them only have like a kind of a skeleton crew and one or two open right now, but you're kind of seeing how they could operate without having any branches if they wanted to.
Yeah, but wouldn't you see a challenge with like my parents? Like they would never use online because it would take them too long to learn.
Well, they can still go get that espresso and go into the coffee shop and do it there, right? So no, you're right. I mean, that's part of if you look at the generations, and we're not going to have time to do all the overview of all the different generations in the United States and Europe and Asia and all this. It's very complex from a demographic generational perspective, but there are different expectations that people have by the generations and what they're comfortable with and what they're not. I mean, I still have a father-in-law who, you know, we joke, has the dumb phone, right? He has a flip phone and no smartphone. And, you know, for him, having online banking is completely irrelevant. Now, for any of the students
so
of any of my
so career, he's Gibbs, right?
Yeah, exactly, and proud of it, Actually, he jokes every once in a while about getting a smartphone, and I think his primary comment is that my mother-in-law won't let him get it, but I don't think that's necessarily true. So
I got to tell you a funny story. my youngest son, this is a couple of years ago. My youngest son, we have a tendency to lose our cordless phones in the house. Yes, we still have landlines. I don't know why. I don't even know the phone number to it because I never use it. But my youngest son, we kept on losing these handsets. He says, you know what they should invent? They should invent a phone that's got a cord that goes to the base.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, those used to exist. Actually, my kids, I don't even think know that what a corded phone is. And we also have a landline, mostly just so the kids can use it to dial someone if they need to for an emergency or something. Since ours are so young, they don't all have cell phones yet, and we don't want them to have cell phones.
Right.
But yeah, no, that's you're right. I mean, that brings up another interesting point, which is sometimes, you know, old technologies are not all bad either. And you know, that, I think this is something we get into a lot in consulting. Is everyone wants to go to the latest and greatest? So, you know, let's go use software package X that's really sleek and sexy and brand new. But maybe the predecessor to X is actually just as good, if not better. So that's one thing we got to keep in mind too, with some of this change that goes on in technology and virtual meetings. You know, the phone call. I find that my students actually prefer, generally speaking, to meet in person or via Zoom or virtual meeting, right? The Google Hangout. They do not like to talk on the phone. It's very bizarre to me. So they'd rather text and send messages through various apps, but they just don't like talking on the phone. So a lot of times I'll break them down and say, you realize you're eventually gonna have to talk to someone on the phone. Like, I don't know why this is such a, but it's, you know, you talk about those generational differences, right? We grew up, what you mentioned, the telephony, right? And the telephonics and all this. It's, you just had phone meetings.
Well, you know, this is something, this is a personal discipline issue for me. I will never take a phone call. I'll never answer the phone if it rings unless it's scheduled, ever. I never, there was a Facebook quiz that my oldest son took, and it's the scenario was, you're kidnapped, and the kidnappers say you have to call somebody, and if they answer the phone, you die. Who do you call? And his answer was, my father.
And then you're not going to answer the phone? Is that the punchline?
Okay, so no, I would just never answer the phone. Okay, and I just don't, because I want to be prepared for every call. Okay, I want to be in the moment. I want to know who I'm going to be speaking with. I want to know what we're going to be speaking about, or have a notion of it at least, so that I, you know, when I answer that call, okay, if I'm on the phone, I'm completely focused on them.
You must be, you know, you must be an industrial engineer or something. This is like this is like one of those operational productivity things, kind of like keeping your email off and only going to your email once, twice a day, and just busting them all out very quickly rather than getting distracted by the phone, the email, the text. It's much easier said than done, but I've noticed even in the most productive periods of my life, if you can shut down everything and really focus on allocating your time, you know, that hour to that phone call or that research project or whatever it is you're doing, consulting report, that's how you become highly productive in, as an individual producer of something, right? So that's an important observation, is that I waste a lot of time, like what you just said, picking up that phone call, and then soon 5 minutes turns into 10 minutes, turns into a half an hour that's now gone. That was an unscheduled time, and maybe it would have been more productive as focused time that was scheduled with that individual. So that's a great point.
Yeah. And in all fairness, I will never call somebody unless it's scheduled. In fact, even if I want an impromptu conversation, I'll text the person first and say, hey, let's get on a call. When is good for you?
So I have to ask, I have to ask, does this work with your wife or no? I have to ask.
Well, we, you know, I work from home most of the time, so yeah.
She can track you down physically.
And she prefers not speaking with me, so.
Well, we have that in common too, I think. I'm joking. But, yeah, Seb, and actually it's funny because my wife the other day made a comment about how if you look at the amount of communication back and forth that I initiate a lot of the communication, whether it's text, phone, email, and she said, you should need to think about this. She's like, I almost never initiate the communication. I'm like, I guess so. If I don't reach out to you, I'll never hear from you again. Is that what you're saying? I don't know.
So I think that, you know, the moral of the story here, and if we were to like snap into, you know, the future into focus, you know, I think that this, you know, telephony, generally speaking, is going to be more pervasive and leveraged to a far greater degree than it is today in the after crisis world. But I think the challenge is going to be, you know, controlling the amount of access. You know, I read recently where one person was, you know, everybody's working from home, but the supervisor has everybody on Zoom so they can make sure they're working.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's kind of like micromanagement sort of. It used to be management by walking around and kind of looking over people's shoulder, and now it's the, we got to Zoom all the time to make sure you're doing something productive. And, you know, it's a dangerous game because when you – I learned pretty early on in my managerial career that if I micromanage and bog everyone down in meetings and these kind of calls, that they can't get anything done. So it's a matter of how much leeway do you give them versus how much time do you need to spend actually communicating with the team, and who does have the remote working access. This is a, I mean, right now I'm dealing with countless entities, it seems like, that are having that struggle, is who is essential to physically be at a location, who can work from home remotely, and how has that evolved? I don't know if you remember this example, Joe, but back when Marissa Mayer was really hot and heavy in the limelight, she had the infamous no one can work from home policy, right? So, you know, you imagine that policy today, that might not go over too well in COVID-19 times. So that's, again, one of those black-white sorts of things. There has to be a gray in between. So there has to be a time where someone can perhaps telecommute or, you know, there's exceptions, of course, when it comes to manufacturing and customer-facing service industries like the food and restaurant and beverage industry and how that plays in. But heck, a lot of those have even shifted and adjusted now with delivery services, curbside. I mean, you're watching it happen almost overnight. Their business model's evolving that quickly. But you're absolutely right. It's a challenge for the supervisor, who, especially the ones that don't want to give up a lot of control and want to see what's going on. So then it becomes the, are you going to have Big Brother watching these people in their webcams? And now I got to put a webcam blocking device on. So that and then, you know, remove that webcam blocking device so I can see that you're actually working. You got to trust your employees. Well, you got to trust your employees. You got to give them the tools and training to succeed.
Exactly what I was going to say. You have to, there has to be a fundamental level of trust. You know, I work for you. You have to trust me that I'm going to do my best to work for you. Okay. If I feel that I have to be monitored, I mean, this is not even micromanaged. This is monitored to make sure that I'm doing my work. I know that there's zero trust there.
And I think the way you change that behavior is that you lead by example, you show them that you trust, and you show them that by working and being productive for your team, that you guys will win together in terms of customer success, which usually in a business for profit leads to financial success. You know, base salaries, bonuses, all those sorts of things that come along with that. And that's kind of just, I would call it kind of corporate and business leadership and management 101, is we build that trust, we then show the success together, and then eventually you don't have to monitor those people because they know that if they work hard and do well, they're going to get rewarded for it, whether that reward is intrinsic or extrinsic that they receive, right?
Yeah. I will say that one thing, prediction for after post-crisis, is that the space between the seats on the airlines will not get any smaller.
Darn, I was hoping they were all first class.
Nope, they're not going to get it. They might not all be first class, but they certainly aren't going to be smaller than they are today.
Yeah, so, no, it's any. Yeah. I think this is like the crystal ball thing. Is I think you mentioned a little bit earlier. Yeah. We were talking about that split between face to face versus remote, and I use those probabilities or percentages, a breakdown. I think as far as what's going to happen is you're going to see a lot more awareness of whether it's sanitation and cleanliness, space and social distance. You know, I've been to countries where every country and every culture is a little bit more, you know, they're unique and different in terms of how they handle these things. And I think you're going to start to see, as we talk about globalization and globalized world, we're going to see more and more standardization of this is how we fight and combat germs and spreading of germs. This is how we give ourselves distance to prevent this. You know, it used to be there'd be the person hacking on the airplane. You're like, oh, hopefully I won't get sick. Well, now it's gotten to the point where now that person is getting charged with crimes. If they're, you know, so this is changing on so many different levels, as far as, you know, traveling sick or being around people sick and keeping that distance. And in the airplane example, what are the airlines going to do when they start to get hit with negligence for not providing the appropriate distances? So now can I sue an airline because I got sick because somebody's hacking on me? You know, it's going to be really interesting to see how the changes come about to get people to start to travel freely like we used to. It's inevitable that we will. I mean, if you look at the data here, we will eventually get back to some level of normalcy. It's just a matter of how much our life has changed forever because of this pandemic.
Yeah. I can't help but think about George Carlin, you know, and I don't know if you're...
Oh, great comedian. A great comedian, yeah.
And he talked about germs, okay? Mm-hmm. How he built up his immune system because he would swim in the East River, okay? And that we have to be exposed to these germs in order to build up our own immunities. And we're actually doing a disservice by trying to live in a sterile environment.
Oh, yeah. The bubble child kind of thing. And now I'm going to have to watch that George Carlin skit. I know exactly what you're talking about. He has so many classics. You're right. I mean, it's the infamous... send your kid to daycare, keep them home. Are they exposed to any germs or, you know, these type, building up that immune system? This is one of those things I think you're going to find with the epidemiologists and others in terms of just how people handle vaccines, antibiotics, how we fight this war against viruses and bacteria will continue to evolve. I mean, we said that the viruses and things like this, they're adapting, just like everything else, and humans will continue to adapt too. The question is, for me at least, I never thought I would see a housing crisis like we saw during the global financial crisis and the Great Recession. I never thought that I would experience living through a pandemic like what we're seeing right now. The question is, how is that going to change life moving forward as far as these types of things? Like, we saw changes from all of these events in history. This is one of those monumental events in history for most of my college and university students. They've never experienced anything like this before, right? At this level of their life. And so it's now the world's going to change. And what will that mean for us in terms of moving forward?
I think a lot of that is going to have to do with we'll call it the debrief, you know, what actually occurred after the data has been really collected and scrutinized. Because something that struck me in Germany here, the fatality rate is less than 0.5% versus Italy, which is like 4 or 5% or some ridiculous number.
I think it might even be higher than that right now. But yes, it's definitely significantly higher. Yeah,
yeah, it's at least 10x what Germany is. Okay, Germany has a much more robust testing regimen. Okay, so you know, if we look at numerators and denominators, with the numerator being number of deaths and the denominator being number of people tested, Germany is much more aggressive in testing. So their denominator is much greater.
This is going to be one of those things that is going to be a true data analytics exercise once we get a little bit more data under our belt. Right now, everyone's just shooting from the hip, trying to take their best. Right. What's South Korea doing? Versus what's happening in Italy and Spain versus what's happening in the United States. The problem is no one has all the data to decide what's working and what isn't in terms of the testing protocol, the isolation. So what's going to happen is as we get more and more data and we see what's working and what isn't, concurrently, of course, working on vaccines and drugs that can potentially help, we'll have more and more education on how to prevent these things in the future. Just like before, we knew what germs were and about sanitation and sterilization in hospitals. I mean, you still see questionable sanitation and sterilization even in world-class facilities at times. Yeah. So, you know, you get to that level of not having zero tolerance for these sorts of things across the world. And, you know, as we've traveled, you've traveled a lot, I've traveled a lot. I've seen some pretty crazy things in places. I'll bite my tongue on some of it. Needless to say, I'm not surprised that this could happen based on what I've seen in the world. And at the same time, though, I'm surprised at how quick it's happened and how much spread it's had and how long this is going to go on for. No one really knows, right? I mean, that's the big, another, you know, million-dollar crystal ball question.
Well, here's my question for you. How long are you willing to be holed up in your house?
Me, not very long. I'm one of those, especially, it's hard to, you can't teach an old dog, new trick sort of thing. And I don't think I'm that old, but I'm getting older quickly. But I am a go, 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 travel, 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 meet with clients, kind of like some of the politicians with this. You know, we're handshakers. It's hard for us to stop doing that. For me, it's hard to not be running around on consulting client sites and doing research around the world with boots on the ground. So, I mean, I was supposed to be coming back from Shanghai, I think a couple days ago. I was supposed to take a group to Italy in May. I'm usually in Ireland in June. I had my whole summer, you know, so for me, I just basically my entire summer has been now scratched. And there's a silver lining, you know, some maybe family time, hopefully outside my house a little bit. But, yeah, it's been tough for me personally just because I do like to move and shake and travel around. And being confined is very difficult.
Yeah, well, my game plan is to go back to the States the end of April for a few weeks.
Can you even do that right now? I guess you can.
The whole question would I be able to come back?
Yeah.
To Germany, but I can't believe they're going to close the borders for 3 months. I mean, that's just not reasonable. I think that gets back into this
social public safety health sort of piece versus economic finance business operations, that these things we're seeing are not mutually exclusive at all, as we're seeing a financial sort of crisis happening and unemployment crisis and everything that's going on. You know, you close the borders between, let's just say, U.S. and Germany, since that's what we're talking about. There's so much business that goes on between the two countries. You can't shut that down entirely, or else your economies, you're losing your trade partners and the global nature of things, and the probability of perhaps being struck by lightning at this point. Now, that probability is subject to change because we said the data is evolving. But these sorts of things are really, it's not even a ripple effect, it's a tidal wave, we say, right? So it's having a tidal wave effect on the economies of the world.
Well, I'm an optimist, and I think that this will sort itself out sooner rather than later.
Yeah, I heard someone in an interview talking about the underlying institutional foundational structures that are at place here in the global economy, and particularly in the United States. There's no financial system structural problems like there was during the Great Recession, global financial crisis.
Right.
It's all just fear, right? And it's all uncertainty. And eventually that fear and uncertainty will subside. It's just whether that's going to happen in 2 weeks, 2 months, a year, 2 years. We don't know how long it's going to take. But the structures are there. The institutions are there. It's just getting back to some level of normalcy.
Yeah. Well, I've moved past the fear part. So
You can't live your life in fear, right? You can't leave. It's like fighting a battle or a war or terrorism. I mean, at some point, you would never leave a corner of your house up against a foundation line in Iowa where I live because of tornadoes. If you live like that, you'll just be in a corner convulsing forever in fear that something's going to happen. So you got to decide what's the right risk tolerance you personally can live with, your family can live with. I know I get scrutinized a lot sometimes by folks because my kids have been to all over the world. I think they've been on four or five continents or something like this. And they say, you're crazy to take your kids to all these places. I'm like, why not? Right? I mean, the risk of something happening to them in country X versus, I'm from Chicago, certain part of Chicago, there's risk in Chicago. There's risk in every place you go. What's that risk level? What's your risk tolerance and threshold? And would you be willing to go there? That's what you got to decide. And when it comes to this, now the question is, are you willing to leave your house? And how far are you willing to go, right?
I'm ready.
Yeah, likewise.
All right, Dan. I think we should wrap it up. I really want to appreciate your sharing your insights and wisdom and experience with my audience and myself today. It was a really great conversation.
Joe, I appreciate it immensely and enjoy all your work. And it's been a pleasure being part of the podcast here and appreciate it.
My pleasure. So you've been listening to State of Readiness with your host, Joseph Paris, and our special guest here today, Daniel Bomblaskis. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.